You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
This is T. Eric Monroe, author of Rare and Unseen Moments of 90s Hip Hop. Please enjoy this segment of Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio. What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine, and today my guest is T. Eric Monroe. He's a photographer documenting hip-hop and skate culture for many, many years, shooting folks like Wu-Tang, Nas, Fugees, Fat Joe, the list goes on and on. Eric has a beautiful three-volume set called Rare and Unseen Moments of 90s Hip-Hop. Coffee table books, great if you need a gift, if you need something for your house. Check it out. Eric's also got the T. Eric Genesis Collection new NFT set. We'll post his URL in the show notes, and you can go check it out and maybe buy one for yourself. Eric's got some great stories, folks he's met along the way, lessons learned, some of the differences between what it means to document a culture from the inside as a participant versus just on the outside looking in. And I love this one about how just kind of going with the flow can lead you to memorable moments and experiences. Sometimes you got to just roll with it. And he's got some great examples of that. So let's get into it right now with T. Eric Monroe.
Oh, no, thanks for doing this, man. I'm excited. I've been seeing your name and following your work for years. And, I know Cove put us together.
Right on, yeah.
Shout out to Synapse.
He's a golden child because he has such a beautiful network, kind of like I do, across such mixtures of cultures.
Absolutely. Like I said, I've seen your work. I think you mentioned you shot the Roots cover when I was at Herb.
I don't think I shot the cover. I definitely know I was in the magazine. I have to see the cover again, but I remember there's two shots at least that were in there from 1994 of the Roots.
Oh, okay.
And come to find out, the day that I shot that, Questlove let me know, that was the day before they went to, or that was the last day in the United States before they did their pilgrimage to London and to Europe in 94. So that was interesting. It was their last day in the States.
That's big.
Yeah.
That's big. So how did those things fit together? The marketing, experiential stuff you were doing and your background in photography.
It all makes sense because of, I think part of it is coming up as a skater and also always taking pictures, not necessarily from the angle of always being the photographer, but you just see things as they're coming. Like when you're skating, you see a possible trick you can do. Like, you just got to ollie up, do certain things, move and pivot, and then you keep trying. As it relates to, hip hop, experiential marketing, photography, and even storytelling now through books, I see what I went through. I see how simple it was. Yes, there was hurdles to get through certain places or certain things, but you always knew you can possibly do it, and you have to do it with blind faith. Because back in the 90s, when you shot on film, you didn't see your work until maybe 2 hours or 2 days later. Sure. So you had to fully trust your gut. With trusting your gut and understanding people and relationships and situations and what kind of outcomes you would like to have happen, you just apply the same thing in event marketing, because you're dealing with people and you're creating a moment for the client, you know, that's memorable and special and helps tell their brand story. I just see it so similar, you know, and I love photography now because I understand the fullness of what an image can do, or capturing a moment can do, not necessarily to sell it as fine art, but to share it with someone in their family because they didn't see it that way. And it's in its most simple, pure form. That's what I really enjoy about the storytelling of utilizing photography.
I mean, that's really interesting. And I think about, you know, you talk about trusting your gut. I think so much about the age we live in with technology is about removing our gut from you know, so many decisions we have to make.
Absolutely.
Right? So how do you continue to challenge yourself to do that when sometimes you don't have to? You can look on the back of the, you know, the viewfinder,
right?
See immediately if a shot's working or it isn't.
It's funny because for me, I trust my gut first. Let's say, for example, I'm looking at something, I'm like, oh, that's going to be a cool image. I really look at it and study what it is I'm trying to capture within that frame. Like, am I trying to accent a person, a tree? I'm trying to tell a story of two different things that are in the space, but can tell their own different story. That's why it caught my attention. And I want someone else to be able to see it. It's sort of like that. Right. But you have to trust your gut, because even if you just throw your camera up there or your phone and just snap a picture, sure, you got something, but what did you really get? Like, but trusting your gut and slowing down, you know, to almost analog and just going back to the basics of taking your time, focusing on the moment, and then deciding to take a picture, because in film, you only have 36 frames or moments to capture, you know? So it's going back to that slow, methodical way of approaching a situation, because that's what allowed me to have a successful photography and even journalism career. Now that I look back at it, because I started writing and doing photography for Thrasher, and then I just went just doing photography.
Cool. That's great. So, okay, I want to dig into some of that, but take me back to the very beginning. So let's talk about your journey with music. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
Yes. I was either, I feel, well, first two records I remember. One is Disco Duck. It was like this Disney cartoon thing. I think that was like when I was in kindergarten and I didn't understand vinyl. And I remember specifically that I took the record to school, and I remember when I was going to bring it home, I wanted to put it in my backpack, and I remember I folded it. And I remember hearing the crunching sound. I'm like, what the fuck is that? But I remember like Bibla, like, oh, you can't do that. And then the second record I purchased was Rapper's Delight. And that was, I was in second grade or something like that. I'm that old. But those are the first two records that I bought. And it was just based on fun, you know? And then, because my ear was just open to, radio played everything back then. So you heard, you know, everything from classic rock to, you know, Kool and the Gang. It was just music. And that's what I was raised on, in music. And my environment that I grew up in was a suburban environment. So I had mixed cultures of people around me all the time. You know, I did everything from Boy Scouts to, you know, go to church and church activities to playing football, and then eventually getting into skateboarding. So I had a very, fun, didn't grow up in the city environment. That's why I am so intrigued by the city or city life, because I don't live in it, but I can see and appreciate what's there, and I understand what people think are relevant, and being able to capture those relevant moments to share those moments with other people. So that's where my background comes from.
So, you know, you talk about that time, like skating was very much an inner city thing at the time. You know, right. I think, you know, for the most part, I think of skating as, you know, it didn't really get to the suburbs until a little bit later, although, you know, with exceptions, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think that early experience, I mean, it's definitely outsider culture.
Right.
How did that experience kind of shape the rest of your path?
Amazingly. Skateboarding for me, I went to, you know, very mixed high school, and I think I was the only black skater in the school. Mm-hmm. Initially, I was only black skater. This was like 1987. And I got introduced to skateboarding because some kids at my lunch table just started skateboarding. And they're, you know, I watched them. I'm like, this looks like fun. Let me try it. And that's literally how it started. And by that summer, it was the 1987 Pal Peralta Bones Brigade demo. And they came here to New Jersey and to Edison. And at that time, Mike Vallely lived in Edison, and he was still an amateur for Palo Peralta. So being going to demos like that and seeing, you know, your local hero, now a celebrity amongst, you know, Tommy Guerrero, Mike McGill, all of these big names of 1987, 1980 in skateboarding. So just seeing that, seeing the environment, all the kids around me, this new environment just opened me up to so much more, because skaters introduced me to more kinds of music, to more kinds of culture, to more kinds of food, to more kinds of just outside thinking. And I think that really helped navigate me, because I still was the same kid who still wanted to take a picture when he took a picture, or still play football, or being in the marching band, or even being in musical theater. It was just a part of that culture of doing more and more to experiment and experience more of life, rather than just sitting in this one little solid box saying, I'm just going to be hip hop.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. And I think of, you know, I think there's so many parallels, you know, between hip hop and skating, including where they are now, right? Where, and I Absolutely. Think, you know, in some ways, I mean, I know skating is now in the Olympics, right? And like,
wild.
It is wild. I think it's really interesting when, you know, how can I say it? Like, in some ways, skating has just become a sport.
Right.
And in some ways, hip hop has just become music.
Right.
And, you know, on the one hand, like, I think it loses something in that process, right? From being,
it definitely creates kind of a dividing line. Yes. Right. It definitely creates a dividing line. It's kind of, it's like the purest versus, the people don't care about the purity of it. They just want to do it right. To do it, where the purists are like, oh, no, it can't do this. It can't. And that was the same thing when skateboarding was going into the Olympics, and you had the purists within the skateboard community say why it shouldn't be in there. But if it's going to be right. in there, these are the certain things that us purists will allow for, or keep the standard of skateboarding where it should be. It's the same thing with hip hop. And it's interesting that you say, or see the same parallels that I did, of how skateboarding and hip hop specifically were so similar. And I remember when I was in junior college after high school, and it's probably the only A I ever got, I wrote a sociology paper comparing Steve Rocco, who owned World Industries, and his genius mm-hmm. to Russell Simmons' genius. And I got an A on the paper wow. just because I made the exact, I mean, they were sure. like, I saw it clear as night and day, because Russell understood hip hop, or what it could be, and the potential of it in the youth. And people were like, you're crazy, but he ran with the ball. Steve Rocco did the same thing, where he was working for the corporates, and he was like, F this, mm-hmm. I see a different way of doing it. Everyone saw it with him, you know, and he got the right financing, and he just took off, if you would, and just created a whole different world, you know, yeah. in street skateboarding.
Absolutely. So how'd you get started taking pictures?
Since I was a kid, I've always had a camera in the house, and somehow I became not the default photographer, but I always felt comfortable taking family moments, whether it was, you know, a holiday, relatives visiting, on a fishing trip. So it was just always taking a picture here, taking a picture there, and just cataloging life itself, if you would. And then come to find out later, when I look back at things, it's interesting that you look through it like a family catalog or a family album, which don't really exist much anymore, but back in the day they did. But it was something about the person that always took the pictures in your family album. They were able to take a picture without having to label anything. So you knew exactly what you were looking at all times. So somehow that methodology of being so focused on a moment, you know, kept going as I was going to skateboard demos or going to concerts or sneaking in here and shoot. So, and then at some point, learning from the photo labs in New York City, like how I should really, really be honing in my skills. And here's what, you know, major photographers are doing. So that was my big lesson in speeding up my professionalism, was by learning from the lab technicians what other people were doing or trying and experimenting and applying the way I also saw moments. So that really helped the learning process or learning curve to get into the professional world.
You know, it's so funny. I mean, and I know a lot of people listening are kind of our age group. So maybe it's not as shocking as I think it is, but like, you know, I studied photography in high school a little bit. I didn't take it very seriously, but it was so much work to be yes. a photographer, right? The hours you had to spend in the darkroom, the money trying to get the equipment, the, you know, the chemicals.
Yep.
It was, I mean, I enjoyed it. And I'm, you must have too, but like, it's so much work compared to now.
Right. Where you can just go click and it's done. Yeah.
But yeah, you know,
getting your hands dirty within the process of it helps you sure. to not only appreciate what you've photographed, but it makes you more mindful of the next picture that you take, because, you know, you don't want it to be too bright or too dark, or what caused it to be this color hue shift, it teaches you about what it is that you're actually doing in the moment. So once you get in the dark room, you're already thinking from a dark room perspective how you want your image to come out. Because even now, you know, with using my iPhone and taking moments, I'm already developing a picture in my head of like, okay, yeah, this is too much, you know, yellow in the picture right now. But I know, you know, once I go into Lightroom, I can reduce the yellow, or I can bring this up, I can drop that back. But it's all, like you said, like you're in the dark room with the chemicals, but in your head now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. So how did it go from hobby to becoming your career path?
That would be, in 1990, it was in 1992, it was a defining moment of when it went into professional world. I was at a an event in New Jersey, for it was the MTV Beach Bash, and they had a skateboarding area, and then they had a hip-hop performance with Criss Cross and Das Effect. So I was there for skating, and I ended up working with the person who was coordinating to get a photo pass for the stage, because I just wanted to see the show. Brought my camera, shot the show. After the show, went backstage, and a photographer asked me, hey, what are you going to do with your pictures from the show? And I didn't have an answer for him. And I was just like, you know, just show them to my friends. He's like, why don't you try and sell them? And I didn't know that was a possibility. And he broke it down for me. And I finally realized, I was like, oh shit. So he literally gave me a list of 10 places to call. By the 10th place, someone wanted to see it. And that started the momentum in the professional world of how you can network and sell your photography to magazines or license it out. But what I forgot prior to that, my first published picture was in 1988 as a junior in high school. I was at a skateboarding event, and I photographed the first woman to ever skate at the Brooklyn Banks. We sent it to Thrasher. Thrasher published it in 1988. So that was my first picture, color picture published in Thrasher magazine. And then I got a few more skateboarding pictures published while I was in high school. But I didn't, it's not that I didn't take it seriously. I just didn't see, I didn't know what the possibilities were. It was pure fun. And the, you know, the magazine kept publishing my work. So speed up to 1992, when I started working with a photo agency, the first thing they said was, you need to get a magazine behind you. And I'm like, only magazine I know is Thrasher. So I literally called up Thrasher, talked to Kevin Thatcher. He put me in touch with Brian Brendan, the music director, if you would, for Thrasher magazine. And he broke it down. He's like, whatever you want to, write an article or something, set it up, we'll work with you to set it up, write the article to go against it, and we'll publish it. Because they had no writers or photographers in terms of music in New York. They had guys that would, fly in and out to shoot some skate stuff, but that was about it. But that just gave me an open door. Because it was a skateboard magazine, to allow me in the doors of hip hop or whatever area of music who the publicists would pay attention to. But I found the publicists were leaning on me to try and get stuff into Thrasher, because that in their weekly marketing meeting, they can say, hey, well, we got an article of Nas in Thrasher magazine. We got an article of this person. Mm-hmm. And it was a big torch to carry, versus, okay, we got in the source, this hip hop magazine. Right. It helped work both sides of the game, for me helping them and them helping me. So it's also just taking the initiative of really learning, once your foot is in the door, how to keep moving within the building that you're in. And then also reaching back out to bring someone else in the fold.
Man, that's such a big one. I think definitely in my own career, I've had so much success by just finding any way I can to get in the door. And then just never leaving.
That's
it. They have to escort me out if they want to be good. That's so interesting. So, tell me more about that. How's that? Give me an example of kind of how that's played out for you.
In many ways. I remember when I realized I wasn't the best writer, and there was a guy who worked at the skate shop. And he was funny. He was smart, and I think he was already writing. And I said to him, "Dude, I'm working for Thrasher, I'm, getting all this stuff done." I said, "But I know you're a better writer than me." I said, "Just start coming with me to these things. You do the interview, you write the article, I'll shoot it, and we'll just keep going." The kid ended up being Chris Naracco, who we all know, who writes for everyone and does commentary on television. But that was that genuine knowing of this person is so much better at this skill set than I am, that it got the ball rolling of his professional writing career. And then since then, we've done so many projects together. Even this past March, he brought me in to be a part of the NJ Brick Vans collection that was released back in March with Redman in it. We're still friends, and we're always reaching out to the next person next to us. We're like, dude, you have this talent. Don't give up. Here's an opportunity, just showing people like this real world of opportunity does exist. And it's not just on Instagram.
I mean, I think that's so huge. I hate to keep coming back to myself, but I also it just really resonates with me, because for me, doing favors is a way of life. And, trying, like you said, trying to pull in people you know, behind you. You know, and I had a similar, you know, I was writing for The Source, which I only got because they needed somebody on the West Coast because the West Coast was blowing up and Paul Stewart right. just graduated to be a huge manager and whoever else was writing out here. So they needed somebody. And I happened to know someone who knew John Schechter and, you know,
and oh, right on. Schechter, yes.
And so I was writing for them. And then like, you know, then I got an assignment to go write a story about Warren G. And they were like, hey, wow. if you have somebody that takes pictures, we have $500 for a photo. So I called Brent Rollins, who was, you know, we right went to college together. And I was like, Brent, get your camera. Like, let's go do this. And oh. then, you know, and then I end up telling, you know, John, like, hey, you should really meet Sasha Jenkins. You should really meet Elliot Wilson.
You that know, was a whole really, era, yeah.
Right? And those guys go on to do big things. And, like, it's not, it's you amazing. Know. It's, but that's like a, I don't know. Like, to me, that's such a small thing, but it's so important.
Right, right. And it's funny you mentioned all those names. And I felt like that was my graduating class of, you know, going from freelance to really setting sure. your own flag in the sand, if you would, you know, because I remember watching them when they first started Ego Trip. And I remember when I think it was Sasha that told me the name Ego Trip, and I didn't get it because I'm not as smart as they are in terms of like wizardry. Because the first thing I thought, I'm like, why are you using De La Soul's Ego Trip song? Like, because I like De La Soul. That's how I said it in right. my head. Right. But they had such a very strategic vision of where they wanted to go that you see it now, you're just like, yeah, exactly. So we're all on the same trajectory of helping people and growing our ideas and our brands, if you would.
Absolutely.
But also giving back or giving new opportunities to others.
Yeah, no, that's a big one. How does it? So now, like, anybody can take a picture of a skater. You know, I can go down to the right. Venice Bowl with my phone, take pictures. What's different about the way you shoot something as an insider to the culture than, you know, a casual observer who's just looking at imagery from the outside?
In terms of, I'll use skateboarding as an easy example for me anyway. Because you skate, you understand how the body mechanics are going to move. You understand how the board is going to flip at a certain point. And you always want to line it up. So if someone's looking at the picture, in my mind, they know what the trick that the person is doing based on how the board is rotating, how the person's body is twisting, and how their body's about to catch the board to finish the move. So it's a matter of being right in the middle of knowing when to capture that moment to tell the story without a caption, that kind of thing. That's how, from the inside perspective out. And even when I shoot, you know, like recently I started videotaping a lot of rappers behind the scenes and catching moments of them and their friends and really watching what it is, how they're engaged with one another, and then capturing a moment where it places the viewer right by the person or right within the joke of whatever's happening at the moment. So it's like giving people that, because even I think last week I posted on Instagram most stuff looking at my volume 2 book, and we're just having a casual conversation like we're old friends in 1985. Like, that's where it brought you. Like, no one ever gets to get in most deaf space like that and be so casual where he's not as guarded, you know. So it's just giving you that inside feel and understanding of when the right moment's the right moment to capture it and what to share and when, because you also have to keep the privacy respect factor of the artist, if you would, in order to sure. enable you to continue to stay within that privacy zone.
Yeah, that's such a big point. And I think, you know, the great photographers, they create an intimacy with their subjects, right? That, that, you know, and a lot of times, you know, you get an assignment, you're meeting somebody for the first time. They're, you know, celebrities, especially, they're guarded. That's part of right. their job, or, you know, models, right? They're only trying to show you their good side, so to speak.
Totally.
So teach everybody listening, how do you create that comfort, that intimacy with a stranger when you know, in a matter of minutes?
I mean, it's so natural for me. I can answer like this. A lot of the subjects that I shot during the 90s, they weren't a big name yet. They, like, Nas had a name, but it didn't resonate yet. You know, right. Wu-Tang guys had a name, but they weren't ringing off yet. It was like, they're starting their sure. solo projects. So you're purely, depending on how you approach the one-on-one of, hi, my name is Eric. Oh, nice to meet you. you know, so-and-so rapper. Once you get past the original high, they're used to being thrown in a set. Give me the yo, give me the finger. There's a routine that they're used to. Mm-hmm. I don't like the routine because it's insulting. Like, why would you ask me to act like someone else? You know, it's like giving De La Soul, you know, a bunch of daisies and say, oh, it's the daisy age, take a picture. And just like, motherfucker, really? It's approaching a person, just being genuine and waiting for them to feel comfortable around you before even raising a camera, you know, whether it's taking a walk around the block, whether you talk to the person or not, just finding that and waiting for that moment of where the guard goes down, where they're comfortable, where you see where they're not trying to be the guarded character MC, but you get the real, you know, government name of the person. You really get a real feel and sense for them. Because even in my first few shots, I use, cancel decline.
That's okay.
Sorry about that.
I
can use an example of like Raekwon and Ghostface. When I first met them, I didn't really know who they were. And their energy was bouncing off of each other. Like that's their freaking frag. It's like Redman and Method Man and being around that energy. So first getting them to get in a space of just looking at and watching them. And they're doing the typical hip hop things. But once they exhaust all their hip hop poses, that's when they breathe and relax. And then that's when you step back and capture what it is you're observing. And then you sort of, it's like a dance. Like you see their momentum and movement of how they feel comfortable moving. If they want to move to the left, to the right, it's like a dance. You let them move and then you have a different angle of perspective and even lighting to start viewing them from different angles, but just keeping that comfort level of, and also knowing when the moment's done, like you can't overstretch that moment.
Right. That's big. And I think, you know, a lot of people in all walks of life, I know we're talking about photography, but, you know, in any setting, you know, what's interesting is, so, you know, these, you're talking about, you know, famous people, influential people, you know, by some definition, powerful people, but
yes,
it's your shoot. You're in charge. Right.
Right.
And your job is,
well, I disagree with a small percentage. Okay. I disagree. The only reason I say like this is because even though it is your shoot, I didn't, for the most part, a lot of my work was not shot in a static studio. It was either on the street, on the scene, at someone's house. So you're always in their environment. So they control the space. You're a guest in their space. Even when, you know, it's a studio shoot, like even though it would be my studio, you still have to allow your subject to feel as comfortable as possible. To even want to be there and then be open enough and free enough to allow you in their private guarded space.
Yeah, I guess I don't think we're disagreeing. I think what I mean is, and it's okay if we are, but you know, I think like you're there to do a job, to get the shot, to tell the story, yes. Right? And that's whether they've hired you or someone's hired you or you're doing it for yourself, right? And, you know, at the end of that, you know, Even the artist, but certainly the viewer, is going to recognize whether you got the job done or not.
Correct.
And so, you know, it's not, when I say in charge, it's not like you versus them.
Gotcha.
But it's that, you know, I think we sometimes have a tendency to place ourselves in a sort of hierarchy with somebody else and say, well, either they're leading or I'm leading. And
right.
The reality is, you both have a role to play. And if you just leave
Correct.
It up to, you know, to your subject to just do whatever they want, well, they're not photographers. If they were, they wouldn't need you, right?
Right.
Correct. And so that's where I think it's interesting. And I think sometimes people get intimidated or they get confused about that role. Where it's a dance. Right.
Yes.
Everyone has to do their part. Thinking of that, who's been the most fun person to shoot?
I'd have to say Fat Joe. And I say that because the first time I photographed him was in 1993. I didn't really know who he was. By 1994, I ended up, the source asked me to go up to the South Bronx. And I think it was 1994. And I had to go up to the South Bronx and finished capturing some graffiti that Fat Joe had just done. And I remember taking the subway up there. I didn't know, you know, the myth about the South Bronx and being bad. And I remember Joe met me at the subway station, took me around, we shot We Need to Shoot, kicked it for a bit, and then he drove me back to the subway station and said to me, he's like, hey, it's like, be careful, it's crazy out here. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't say, I was like, all right, cool, I didn't think about how dangerous the South Bronx was, but it was those genuine moments. And then, you know, reconnecting with him over time, you know, when he started the Terror Squad and had me, you know, go up to Pun's house and photograph that, and just these random, just fun moments that were just pure and genuine. And that's always been my relationship to Fat Joe. And then even last January, where they had the Loud Records reunion, I ended up going, and I ended up going into Joe's dressing room, and we hadn't seen each other in years, and I see him peek, and he was shocked to see me. So after a while, I finally made way off his, after all of his guests left, and he was just elated to see me. He was just like, yo, and we just went back to like 1994, like we're kids just hanging out on the street again, you know, and it was that genuine, pure friendship that I know that exists, you know, even though the celebrity is there, but it reminds you, like, you're doing something right. Like, just keep going and staying who you are, to be true to who you are, because that's what allows so many magical things to happen over time, just by being genuine.
No, that's great. I know, you know, Esteban Oriol told me a story about getting to shoot his idols, De Niro and Pacino. And it went horribly wrong.
No.
And, so there's a happy ending to that story. He worked it out, and you know, but it was hard. It was a hard moment where he felt like he had kind of let himself down, and you know, had to work his way out of it. When has that happened for you? What's been the toughest shoot, or when you weren't able to go do what you came to do? And what'd you learn from it?
I know. Going back to the Crisscross show in 1992. So the agency that you know, reached out to, went to show my work, I hadn't gotten my film developed yet. So I got the film developed, and it was like two good shots out of, you know, 36 shots. And the person was just like, okay, this is okay, but we'll give you another chance. And I'm like, I didn't know what that meant, meaning that they were going to allow me another opportunity to photograph someone to see if my work was up to snuff. So I said, okay, cool. So following weekend, they arranged for me to shoot Arrested Development while they were on tour. So I got to the venue early, got some great outdoor shots of Arrested Development, got some shots of them in concert. And then on my way out, I found a flyer for a hip hop showcase that was happening the next day with Onyx and Maceo of De La Soul. So the next day I'd go back in the city, get ready for the showcase, standing out in front of this theater, and across the street was the Broadway show with Jelly's Last Jams featuring Gregory Hines. So at the time, the actors were coming out from the stage door signing playbills. I ended up getting out of my car with my camera, and then as I'm approaching the sidewalk or the stage door, Gregory Hines walks out, and you know, he's signing autographs, and I say to him, Mr. Hines, do you mind if I take your picture? I just want to put a portfolio together. Some line I said, he's like, yeah, sure, no problem, sign. And then he goes, stop. And I'm like, oh shit, what'd I do? He looks at me, he's like, you wanna take pictures? I was like, yeah. He's like, let's go. He's like, you guys stay here. And he walks me down the block and he goes, go for it. And I shot 12 frames of him. And we're walking back and he's like, do you have a card? And for some reason I already had him a business card. I gave it to him. He's like, you guys wait. He walks me back into the stage door, introduces me to the stage manager. This is Eric. He's gonna come back with pictures for me. Let him in whenever he comes back. We walk back outside and then shook hands or whatever. Went across the street, shot Onyx and Maceo, Michelle Endegocello. Drop all the film off. The next day, I go back to New York to the agency. I present everything that I shot for the weekend. The person looks at it. She's like, how, not even the rest of the month. She's like, how in the fuck did you shoot Gregory Hines? How in the fuck did you do that? I was like, is that not normal? I didn't know the difference. But that was a moment where I had fucked up shots that almost didn't get me in the door. But then I rebounded with, you know, the gifts of the universe, you know, by just asking someone, can I just take your picture?
Yeah, that's great. What an amazing experience. What did you learn from that? What do you use from that experience today?
Just to slow down. No, actually, exactly what it showed me. I remember when I was starting to approach Mr. Hines or Gregory Hines, I got, you know, like antsy and giddy, like, oh my God, this movie starting. And I was like, no, just talk to the man as a man. And that's what I did. Just staying that calm and the one-on-one of what my intentions are. I recognize who you are. And then just based on that, he can just say yes, or he didn't have to walk me down the street to give me a private moment. He can be like, I'm busy, kid. You don't buy it. But he was genuine. And therefore, being genuine, I have to do that to anyone that I approach or am within their circle of whatever it is. Just being pure and genuine, because you don't know how you're going to affect them. You don't know why they're asking, or it doesn't matter. Just be genuine. You know, it gets you so much further.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about the book.
Yes.
Rare and Unseen Moments of 90s Hip Hop. Is it three volumes?
Three volumes, volume one, two, and three. And then we also have the collector's edition bold book, which is a combination of the three volumes plus bonus material. And it's a high, you know, it's a fine art book. The way that it was made, handcrafted, it's gorgeous. But it was a project that I was really, really looking forward to doing. And my business partner, who actually laid out and designed the book and really coached me every step of the way of how we can really do a book. I'm so grateful for it, because working on the book allowed me to get my writing chops really up to snuff, because I work with another writer. I work with a copy editor, and they would ask me about the stories or the moments that I'm describing in the book. And it helped me really pull these moments out to articulate what it is about being around the person. What was the lead up moment to that actual photographed, you know, moment shot? And then just things about it. So it opened me up to be able to share the books. And I remember one person said to me, you know, I read these books to my daughter at night. And I was like, wow, really? And I'm like, yeah, I think of it now. I'm like, it's a PG book, you know, and it's generational, you know, because it's not just this one little area of hip hop, you know, just tells an interesting story essay by essay. And it's not based on this happened then. It's just each book is a mixture of different moments that really fit together. Right. You know, and there's a lot more material that I still am digitizing now that I'm sharing on social media, but the books have been a fun, tool to really connect with people.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, obviously for those of us who lived through 90s hip hop, you know, it was such a special time in music and culture and the community that, you know, formed around it. You know, I'm always amazed. You see all these documentaries coming out now. And it's like, for me, what, you know, part of what's so amazing is like, it was really a small group of people, you know, a few hundred people or something who were building something that would, you know, change the shape of the world.
Totally.
What is if, you know, for people that you know, are coming up now that, you know, missed that don't know the history, you know, they might like the music, but they don't know all the stories behind it. What are you hoping that gets passed down?
Really great and interesting perspective of what the 90s were about. I think between my body of work, there's other photographers out there who have great bodies of work, but just haven't shared it. But in knowing there's more storytelling about the 90s that's available to do, I think it's my job or mission in so many ways, not just to be the guy of 90s hip hop photography, but also encouraging other people who have this material, who photographed this, photographed that, but they just threw it in their attic and they went on to do a career, to get it back out, put it in hands of lovers, of people who are interested, or donate it to a library and have them digitize it and make it available, you know, to the general public, if you would. But there's so much more of the 90s that, you know, like it got into a few magazines and the magazines got turned into documents, but what else happened? You know, like there's so many more stories to tell. A great example, or a simple example of that is, in 1995, the Wu-Tang did a free show called Park Hill Day. And my experience of Park Hill Day and photographing it and what I thought was a beautiful, beautiful afternoon, come to find out there was a segment of the afternoon or the evening where I was backstage or somewhere, but then like a fight broke out or something happened and then cops came everywhere and cleaned up the streets. And I remember coming back out and the streets were clear. I'm like, huh, that was weird. Maybe the concert was over. But my friend who was in the front had a different perspective of this happened, photographed this happening. So there's more perspectives that people can learn from, you know, and sort of like, you know, the 95 Source Awards kind of thing, you know, where crazy shit happened. But what wasn't told was, you know, less than a month later, Dr. Dre was at, you know, Puffy's birthday party. And, you know, a month later, Snoop was in Philadelphia at the same concert with Biggie, you know, filming for the show, the movie. Like, why aren't those stories told? There was no beef if they're all in the same building together, making money together. You know, that could have stopped some of the negative BS that's still being broadcast, you know, out there about, oh, the 90s hip hop. Let's give people more respect, you know, for their life, especially if they passed, you know. For me, a moment of respect, a really great understanding was a couple of years ago, I finally met Little Caesar, or introduced myself to Little Caesar. And I have one picture of him. It's him, Tupac, Biggie together, all wearing I'm a Bad Boy t-shirt. That was shot in 1993. And I didn't even know who those guys were. I was photographing Onyx for a piece for Thrasher magazine at I forget what venue it was, but literally when I finished shooting Onyx, they yelled to me, come take our picture. And I said, sure. And I went over, looked at him, gave him the due diligence and respect. And I took one picture of them and said, thank you. And went back to the dressing room. And for years, I didn't even look at that slide again because it was a big middle finger in it. You know, I just wrote Tupac something finger on it, you know, but it's just giving people genuine moments. But where I was going with Little Caesar, Caesar said to me, and I happened to have the picture the same day, he's like, this is the only moment that I have to show our friendship with Tupac and how genuine it was. He's like, in this picture, I was 13 years old. I shouldn't even been in a club. And I was like, wow. Like the purity of being able to hear him say how they were friends, you know, and it just demystifies all these documentaries that are just making money off of bloodshed, you know, in so many ways.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I love about it. And these books, you know, like yours, I'm sure, like that, you know, give more of the context and the nuance, right? Which gets lost in a lot of this. And, you know, of course, there was beef. We know that. We know it's a part of the culture. It's a part of the business. Right. It was also manipulated in a lot of ways by people who who used it to make money. And you know, and it's not, to me, like, you know, the totality of it is what's interesting. Right. And the paradoxes that happened in those relationships. Right.
Yeah.
That, you know, went on to affect all of us in the culture and, you know, everything since then.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. Great.
Yeah. But I'm grateful to continue to share it and, you know, all these moments that I've captured it and it's all on film. So it's everything's a process of digitizing and getting a scan and then cleaning it up and then writing against it. But the fact that there's more to share with people makes me, you know, happy each day to go through my files and find, you know, random moments. You know, I just got a batch of Fuji stuff, you know, back. And, you know, within it, there's a picture from 1997 with Fat Joe on the set with Wyclef and Celia Cruz on the Guantanamera video, you know, and there's just so many fun moments of moments where people are just together just to hang out and support each other, you know, and I love that. I think one of the rarest things I've found recently, he was probably the first person I'm sharing with on camera. It was, I think it might've been 97. It was when Will Smith did the record for Men in Black soundtrack or whatever. On the same soundtrack, Destiny's Child is on the soundtrack. And that day at the record store, Yvette Shore, their publicist at the time, had me take a group shot of Destiny's Children, you know, together by a piano. And then she also had me said, remember, she said, this is the lead singer. And it didn't click at the time. Mm-hmm. And she had stood her like right by grand piano. So you have this almost virgin-esque image of Beyonce by grand piano, you know, at the start of her career. So I'm just like, oh, fuck. I didn't even know she was. I forgot. But it's just like I have more to share with people, you know, and I'm grateful for that. And you get people literally at the start of their careers. And now she's goddess plus plus.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it reminds me, you know, I used to throw clubs in the 90s and we would never think to have a photographer there. Either somebody brought a camera or they didn't, you know, but, you know, we had like Mac McDaniel would show up sometimes and take some pictures, but like, we never thought about that. You know what I mean? We didn't think that, you know, 20 or 40 years later, we're going to really want these photos and we should document those. And we actually had Destiny's Child. They were, you know, they opened for somebody, Busta or I forget who, and I'm sure didn't get paid. And, you know, we misspelled their name on the flyer. Like it was such an afterthought, right? But that's
I've been there. I've been laughing. You know,
yeah. I mean, it's great. It's great. Some, you know, in some ways, like it's also exciting that that just lives in a memory and there is no, you know, real record of it. But at the same time, you know, those moments get lost and you don't get to tell those stories ongoing. So, you know, I'm glad that you and you know, other people are really capturing the evolution as it happens.
Yeah, I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful. It's like with skateboarding. Sure. It's like you go through a time period and you're just documenting as you're going along. Not necessarily to sell it per se, but you're just happy to document it and share it with your friends, document it. Right. That's where the passion comes from. And the artistry comes as a result of your passion, you know, and that's what I've learned to appreciate over time and being able to share it, you know, moments from, you know, late 80s, early 90s or early 2000s, you know, it just, time goes by so fast after a while. You're just like, fuck, we did all that. Okay, let's keep going.
Definitely. Well, let me do a quick lightning round before I let you go. What's your favorite city to travel to?
What's it again?
Favorite city to travel to?
St. Louis.
Okay.
Yeah. I used to go out there a lot when the Sign Music tours, and it's a simple, small city, but there's so much culture and art, oddly enough, that's all for free. And a lot of people that live there don't take advantage of it, but I saw it as like a mini New York that's so easy to understand and get through the city. And I still love the city. I finally went back there, I think it was 2 years ago, and the city was exactly the same, and I'm still stoked on the city.
Interesting. I've never heard about an art scene there. That's great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's a cool find. Nice. Who's your favorite DJ?
My favorite DJ? I don't know that I have a favorite DJ. I'm trying to think. I'll come back to it. I know my favorite DJ is Evil D from the Beat Miners. Duh, sorry.
Okay.
Because he plays such great music that's just like I could hear it. Like he doesn't just play hip hop, he plays music he knows how to fill a room with happiness.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen him live a couple of times. That's dope. What is other than your own, what's the last great book you've read or listened to?
Wait, I actually have to look. I don't remember. I have to say, because I go through books and then I start them and I drop them. I mean, the books are, one second. Two books. Duh.
Okay.
I didn't finish reading, but this was both gifted to me. Through the Looking Glass, the original one.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And then Passages.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I got both of these at Sweet Pickle Bookstore in the Lower East Side. Shout out Sweet Pickle Books.
Nice.
Say, word.
What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
Either Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory or Fifth Element.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting combination. those are both great movies. So that's time well spent. Who's someone you've learned a lot from that you haven't met?
I have to think about that one. I was going to say VMix, but that's a new relationship, so that doesn't really count. Okay, here we go. Grant Pertain, the photographer, the skateboard photographer, just because of the way that he's photographed, you know, skateboarding throughout history. It's the way that I've studied his pictures, like not consciously, but consciously of how he lights it. He always, also Tiba Jefferson, but more so Grant Pertain, just providing a scope of how to see a person in a non-traditional sense, doing a trick and being able to have enough elements within the picture to tell the story of what the person is doing on the board. So that that definitely helped train my eye over the years and nonstop. And even imitating in so many ways. I remember like early on in photography, like I didn't have much money as a professional photographer. So the widest angle lens that I had at one point was like a 28 millimeter lens, but you can create certain distortions to almost get fisheye effects depending on how you just slightly tilt your camera back and forth to give you more depth of field or wider space to shoot from.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Love that. Okay, last one. If I worked for you or we worked together, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Either something simple like no worries or we can figure this out. It'll be easy. You know, I don't care what it is. Just because it's almost like somebody joked back at me. I had to get some special boards printed like within a 3-day turnaround, and it's in the middle of the pandemic. And someone said to me, oh, you can't get it done. You can't. And I'm like, I'm from Jersey. You can't tell me I can't get it done. And I got it done. You know what I mean? Like, I just need a few options to figure out how to make it happen. I don't want to hear that something can't be done. Like, there's always a peaceful solution to any problem. Like, honestly, you just have to be calm about approaching it.
I love that. That's a great way to go through life.
Yes.
I love it. Well, dude, thank you so much for spending this time with me, man. It's great. I appreciate all the stories.
I'm honored.
Everybody should check out Rare and Unseen Moments of 90s Hip Hop. Pick up a copy. Looks like that gold one is calling out. So you should grab a copy of that while you can. And
only a few left. There's only 100 made.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I just want to shout out. I've gone through your page and it's interesting. A whole segment of my life that I sort of skip through where when I ran an amateur skateboard league from 1998 to 2005. During that time period, I had my office in Echo Unlimited's building. And there's someone who worked at Echo for a short period that you had interviewed, James Andrews. And I knew James first a little bit from the music industry, but then he came to do marketing at Echo for a period of time. And then he went on to do internet related stuff. But it was just interesting. I'm like, oh, yeah, he's a part of my backstory history and so many different, you know, areas of life that we've trickled through, you know. And I remember when he did the internet stuff, the first company that he worked for, we had actually pitched it wasn't called Jackass yet, but we were pitching something similar to Jackass and they just thought it was too much. And I'm like, dude, you don't understand what this is. Like, this is going to be gold. You're like, oh, you're crazy. I'm like, all right, now look at Rob Dyrdek.
I mean, look at how they're coming out with a movie now. You know,
that's what I'm saying. Like, we knew we had it. We knew we had lightning in a bottle. So, but it's just always something fun. And again, trusting your gut that you know that this is right.
Yeah. Love it, man. Well, can't wait to meet you when you're out here for the show.
Definitely.
And I'll definitely be watching everything else you're up to.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I truly appreciate it. Dave Cove, thank you again for the connection.
Yeah. Shout out Dave Cove.
Yeah, that was T. Eric Monroe on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you check out his website, buy a book, buy some NFTs. Follow him on Instagram, whatever it is. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.